If some of the other speakers could come up, we thought we would try something a little different here and have kind of a, maybe you've had some questions percolating and you might have not been able to address it to a specific speaker, so let's get the, what a panel here, huh? What a breadth of experience we have up here. Yeah, you're going to do it. But first, well, Kelton Barr is going to moderate this session. So you all know Kelton?
Get in.
Yeah. Anyway, he's got a couple announcements first, so.
Thank you, Eric. I wanted to give you an update on the Minnesota Groundwater Association's White Paper Initiative. And this is from your White Paper Committee. All four members are here today. First, I just briefly want to go again, what is a white paper? It's an authoritative, science-based, neutral, unbiased, all those adjectives, report and description of the topic that is based on consensus with our members. And it's mainly wanting to be accessible to lay audiences like decision makers, the general public, and the like. But it is not our opinion pieces, editorials, taking any sides or pushing any particular values. It's about the science. And as you recall, earlier this year we selected our first topic, manganese in Minnesota's groundwater, and getting a new understanding of the health risks of manganese. And as an update on that, there's a working group that's been formed this summer, and that's been holding monthly meetings, making great progress. And just as a reminder, they still would be welcoming any input, any contributions from our membership of information and knowledge that they might have on the topic. If you have any, just send an email to the office and indicate your interest, and they'll forward that on to Mindy Erickson, who's the chair of the work group, raising her hand over there. And there is the web page. There's a side tab, white papers, and there's an accumulating a bit of information on there. And that's going to be hopefully used in this fall, because we have a call for topics, another round of topics and choosing another one and creating another one or two white papers. So there is on the website, a place to click and pull up a little thing to fill out on your topic. It basically is so that we get enough background information that we can see exactly what you mean by the topic, and gives us a basis for ranking it with others. And the deadline is January 1st for that. So just 6 short weeks away. So please, we encourage all of you to think about what issues you've been kicking around, and submit them. Okay, and there's other documents you can find on the White Paper Initiative on the website as well. And you can also feel free to talk to any of the members of the White Paper Committee. We have 4 members. They're all here. There's their pictures. You can find them. All but me are retired now. So they're free from any kind of influence on any of these issues. So that's it. One more announcement. As Eric had earlier said, the Sinkhole Conference that the Minnesota Groundwater Association is a co-sponsor of, co-host, will be next October 2015 in Rochester. And a deadline is coming up, December 1st, for submitting an abstract if you wish to have a paper that gets published in the proceedings. It's a fairly widely sought after proceedings. They are going to have it online, and there's thousands of downloads every year worldwide for those papers. So it's a good place to get published. Deadline for the abstract for a paper and a talk at the conference. Now, the Minnesota Groundwater Association has, as co-sponsor, has prevailed on having a Route B, a Plan B for participating in the conference. If you want to just give a talk, there will be a deadline later next year, in a few months, for submitting an abstract for just a talk. A little less work that way. And hopefully we're going to be able to get a lot more local contributions on the various aspects of karst in this area. So I encourage you all to think about that too. And you'll be getting an email about that in the near future here. All right. Back to our regular programming. We have the remaining surviving members of our day's speakers that are going to generously open themselves up for questions from all of you and each other to talk about the general subject of Superfund. So the microphones are up and roving, and so if anybody has any question they would like to put to one or all of the panel convened here, please raise your hand and a microphone will come. It is important to have the microphone hearing, speaking to the microphone for the questions, because we are recording the whole session, and this will be part of the record of the conference. So we want to make sure that you are suitably in perpetuity asking your question. All right.
Well, while we're waiting questions, I thought I'd introduce you to a couple of friends of mine.
Oh, there they
the
are.
Car. I got Sludge Seeker and Barrel Finder. And if any of the younger hydrologists, younger geohydrologists would like an introduction to some of the ancient arts, see me afterwards.
So you are willing to look for sludge or barrels here in the center? That's great. That's great. Progress. I want to start waiting for questions to come from the floor. Oh, do we have a question?
You look at your reemerging compounds that you're evaluating, and for instance, tetrachloroethylene recently went from 20 to 2. Now, that has an impact on soil vapor mitigation systems because of 10 times now, instead of being 200, it's 20. Have you considered looking at the cost-benefit of lowering some of these standards and what we're really gaining? How many lives are we saving by lowering some of these standards? The MPC also has out draft SRVs, and we all know that arsenic just went from 9 down to less than 1. And we can talk about doing background stuff and everything, but quite frankly, when you put a number in a table, we call that regulation by memo. It becomes the standard.
So I think the mic kind of slid down to me off its own accord. Yeah, it just, maybe the center tilting? I don't know. But so those are, you know, relevant questions, Gil, and they always get asked when standards get lowered. And the answer to those is complicated, as we all know. Gil gives me the head shake and the eye roll, which is justified. But as far as mostly justified. But as far as the air standards go, I wish somebody from the health department was here to answer the science behind why those numbers get calculated and what is the true risk to human health. So if those numbers, you know, we have been told over and over again, are truly protective of human health, so the MPC has an obligation to then set those as cleanup goals. Do we accomplish them at every site? No. Can we practically accomplish them at every site? No. And that's what gets worked out as you investigate the site, as you design the remedy. But those are, at least for indoor air, that's a, you know, indoor air is a difficult thing. That's something people are exposed to. There's It's a very up-close and personal thing, and those standards carry a lot of relevance. If you look at what happens with SRVs, I think we have made that very clear in the draft SRVs that got put out, that this is the mathematical calculation that the risk assessors do. What actually goes into policy, I think we're a little ways away from that. The numbers are out for public comment, and such as what you just presented, Gil, which is a very valid practical viewpoint. So all that gets taken into consideration before these SRVs become final. And in the end, the SRVs as they get put out by the PCA are guidance numbers. They're not site-specific numbers. There's certainly opportunity, which is what happened at a lot of sites, is you get site-specific cleanup goals that take into account the true exposure at the site. And that's where the cost benefits and all the other intangibles come into play. So I think the SRVs, and maybe in the past, these were screening numbers, which I think a lot of parties for convenience and expediency have used as cleanup numbers. The intent is to have these as screening numbers. Do sites have to adopt them as cleanup numbers? That's sort of up to the individual parties. That's certainly not a requirement. There's plenty of opportunity when the SRVs become final to really come to a decision on site-specific soil goals, which take into account, I think, those cost benefits. So absolutely. I think there has been confusion over the years on how the SRVs have been used, and it's been convenient for people. It's made business sense. So I don't think we've resisted that, but we've also been open to site-specific soil standards. And that goes back to an age-old issue of risk versus all the other things that we will continue to discuss as long as Superfund is around.
Any other panel members want to comment? Any other softball questions for the panel? Back here, Dr. Tipping.
We've had a lot of discussion in Minnesota the last few years generated by copper mining proposals and sulfide ore bodies, but as I listen today, I've heard cadmium, manganese, arsenic mentioned as being elements of concern, and certainly they're associated with iron mining in industry in Minnesota. Are we going to have more scrutiny of the iron mining taconite industry in years to come?
Sounds like another PCA question.
Yeah, so I will... Good comment by Mr. Payne, which I probably shouldn't repeat. But again, I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know whether, acid mine runoff and things like that have resulted in NPL listings and state Superfund sites in some of the western states. We really haven't had those in Minnesota. It all come down to, is there impact and what's the risk from those impacts, and will we have monitoring and assessment that will determine those impacts? And if you look at, I'm operating way outside my authority, and I shouldn't because we're being recorded. So, traditionally, that's not something that Minnesota Superfund has played predominantly in. So going ahead, I don't have a very good answer. My crystal ball is kind of murky on that issue. Whether Superfund will become a player in regulating mining in Minnesota, that it seems a little far-fetched to me. I think there are other programs, both at the PCA and DNR, who are charged with ensuring that. And you would hope that those are essentially programs that are prevention in nature through permitting and so on. And that's where those impacts would be addressed. And we're not going to see after-the-fact cleanups through a remediation program like Superfund. I believe that's not the intent of... I think there are a lot of programs at PCA, DNR, other agencies that are working very hard to ensure that you don't have Superfund sites coming out of some of these mining efforts. There are four other distinguished panelists present.
We appreciate your bravery. Let's try with Dr. Tipping, and then we'll have.
Okay, yeah, this actually is a simple or softball question. Alan, you had the same slide that John Wilson had up about pump and treat and the change in methods for treating a Superfund sites, and the green triangles that were almost the mirror image of that, I think John describes as institutional remedies. And on your slide, I think it said other methods for remediation. I was just wondering what those were. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. That was the very same slide out of the 2014 Superfund report. And and the, that was other technologies, but then there's a parenthesis that says primarily institutional controls, if I remember right. So I think we were talking about the same slide. Well, it'd be groundwater use limitations, well advisories, that sort of thing. Trying to be sure that no one builds a well, constructs a water supply well in an area of contamination. Or if they do, they make it a certain construction, perhaps deeper. I wanted to say one thing and follow up to the vapor intrusion. You know, when you're in this business, you recognize a lot of inconsistencies in how things are dealt with. But in our homes, you know, when we measure radon, and we find radon over a certain concentration, we hire a radon contractor. The radon contractor comes in, puts a radon system in that basically ventilates the subslab on the home. And then you take radon measurements, and the radon isn't there anymore, so that's a remedy. And we view those as a permanent remedy, really. I mean, there's nothing, there's no other programs going on to try to take radon out of the neighborhood. But yet, when we look at vapor intrusion, we do the very same thing, and somehow we conclude that, or the agencies are apparently concluding that that is not a permanent remedy. That's just a temporary remedy, and you have to try to do some things with the groundwater. As I talked about, it's very difficult to get groundwater concentrations down to perhaps the concentrations you need to be, so the subslab concentrations of chlorinated solvents go away. So, just, you know, pointing out those kinds of inconsistencies, and it goes to the risks we're willing to accept and those that we're not willing to accept. Sandeep has a counter-argument.
It would be very presumptuous of me to counter anything that somebody of Al's stature says. So I wanted to actually second that point. And I think what the agencies are saying, and this is not just in Minnesota, it's nationally as well, is that these building-specific mitigation systems can certainly be the permanent remedies, but then there has to be a record of that. And I think that's the part where we are struggling with. So you can put these in. You have radon in your home, you get the contractor, you get the system put in. You know, it's your system. You maintain it. You're very well aware of the importance to your health and that of your family to keep that system up and running. And now, legislatively in Minnesota, you also have to disclose it to anybody else that you might sell the home to. So the cycle is complete. The system's in place. Everybody's protected. So in vapor intrusion, we may very well end up with that model, which is what's happening at a lot of sites where the system gets put in by the responsible party or by the state. It's being put into an independent third party's home, somebody that's an innocent bystander that didn't have anything to do with the release. And the system goes in. Who's responsible for making sure that system continues to work? The fan doesn't die, or, you know, somebody doesn't wonder what this is and pull the plug, and will the information on the system get passed on? So those administrative pieces are not fully evolved for vapor the way they are for radon. And maybe that's where we'll end up, and that'll be perfectly fine. So I don't think any regulatory agency anywhere is saying you have to clean up the groundwater, the source contaminant, because a lot of times you can't get to it. It's underneath homes and buildings, which is part of what makes vapor intrusion so challenging. What's not yet happened for vapor intrusion in the decade or so that has really been at the forefront is, do we have a permanent system that memorializes these systems, fixes responsibility, ensures that they will work for as long as they're needed, you know, for. You're not going to clean up you can't get the radon out of the subsurface, but there are some sites where you may just be able to remediate the plume, and then you no longer have to worry about all the notification and institutional controls and all the legal hassles of ensuring that information about the systems and their maintenance continues for perpetuity. So those are trade-offs. There's no good answer. It's going to be site-specific. But absolutely, I very much agree with Al if to that extent that you're not going to be able to clean up the aquifer in a lot of these cases where vapor is the sole remaining manifestation. My point was, when I had vapor intrusion as number one, was this is going to be, in many cases, the sole driver. Soil and groundwater contamination will be benign, but because of vapor, you're going to end up having to deal with the site that you otherwise might have very happily delisted and deemed safe.
Okay. Lanya?
I kind of want to go off on a sort of a little different direction, but something that has been I've been curious about as soon as I saw this conference topic, and that is that as somebody who Superfund has always been part of my career, but the Clean Water Fund, Clean Water Land and Legacy money, has not. And it's interesting to me to see how we are developing some of these new programs, and we're sort of at the beginning stages of a lot of programmatic and planning for Clean Water Fund. What will we think 30 years from now when that fund expires? And so I was curious about kind of two things. One, that Clean Water Fund money has really been limited in terms of its application to groundwater problems historically, but there may be some change there. And that kind of, you reminded me of that again when you were commenting. You know, there's still need for funds to tackle these Superfund and these water quality problems. So I was just curious about thoughts on the role of the Clean Water Fund and how that might help support some of these efforts, perhaps. But then also, just in general, your thoughts about having the perspective of seeing Superfund evolve from this brand new idea, we're going to tackle these problems, we're going to get them done, we're going to make it better, and it's taken years and years and years. And that was sort of the same impetus as Minnesotans. We want to tackle this water quality problem, we want to make it better, and we want to get on the ground and fix things, but we know as scientists that's going to take some time. So, you know, are there any lessons learned or things that are, you know, what do you think would be really important to focus on as we're thinking about Clean Water Fund programs, and what value can we leave that's going to be a lasting legacy, you know, 40, 50 years beyond that? So that's a really big sort of general question, but I'm just curious about your thoughts.
That's a big question.
I think one parallelism would be trying to set people's expectations. I mean, it's like Superfund. I mean, the expectation where it was like Steve or Michael said, you know, we're going to get this cleaned up in an hour, in a year and a half or two, you know, and that isn't going to happen. And I think people knew that, but didn't necessarily tell everyone that. And maybe the same thing applies. I mean, we've been trying to, frankly, clean up water for surface waters for a really long time too. We find out it really is difficult, and so really work on setting some reasonable expectations to the public and to the management and so forth of the agencies, it seems to me.
Any legal comment on this question?
I don't really know enough about the Clean Water Act Legacy Fund. I think one of the lessons of Superfund, in addition to Al's setting realistic expectations, is that we've moved essentially from a vision of the world of good guys versus bad guys to a more collaborative, pragmatic view of working together to try to come to solutions that are risk-based and that are not overly conservative. I remember one of that even in the Superfund case, I've represented parties where the contamination problem was long. The people who caused it were long since dead, actually, and even the corporations who caused it were transformed, and yet in the public's view, they were often viewed as bad guys, which always struck me as peculiar. And I think people are hardwired sometimes to see stories about good guys versus bad guys and this kind of issue. I think, as we learned in the slide right site that I talked about, you get a lot further hearing pragmatic solutions and talking about them in a consensus building kind of context.
I'm not going to answer your question on the Clean Water Action Fund, but from the point of view of Superfund being around for a year and a half, and it being done, I don't remember ever hearing that until today. And I think our point of view on it was that so much the water, the cleanup was going to be done with pump and treat, and I think almost everybody who talked about pump and treat talked about tens of years, if they were lucky, more like hundreds of years. So the concept of a Superfund site going bye-bye in a short time, I don't think was there. I think some sites, when they were very small sites, when they were maybe sites you could dig out the vast majority of materials, that was possible. But anything that was really one of those complex sites, those larger sites like Al was talking about, was not going to be done anytime soon in terms of finality.
that may be true among some of the scientists, but the law was designed to postpone litigation until after cleanup was finished. I mean, the whole theory was sites like Love Canal and the Valley of the Drums and Spring Valley were so important to address now that we could not take the time to be fair and to try to work out who was responsible for what. So there's got to be a balance there someplace, I think.
Sir.
Bruce. Yeah. I have a question. You know, over the last, since the 1980s, we've spent an awful lot of both public money and private money generating a lot of information on Superfund sites. So the question I have is what's being done or what should be done to make sure that we don't lose all of that knowledge and so that it can be readily accessible to the public 30 years from now when all of us are somewhere else. You know, so does anybody have a good answer to that? I mean, some of those sites, you know, there's a stack of reports as high as the lectern that Kelton's standing on. And in all of that is all this great work that's been done. But what do we do to make sure that future generations can access
it? So I can answer that, not intending to be flippant, but I think Jerry Stanky answered that question previously when he asked his question about money. So barring that minor issue, at least at the MPCA, there's lots of good intentions, lots of plans about not only preserving this tremendous volume of data about geology, hydrogeology, contamination, but also making it available to everybody in an easily portable digital fashion. So I'm pleased to tell you, Bruce, that in contrast to discussions we've had about this in the past years when you were still at the survey, at the health department, at the survey before that, where you would ask me the question, I'd throw up my hands and say, I don't know, I wish I knew. There, at least the plans are in place. The MPCA has made major investments in new data systems, and plan is also in place for getting all of the Superfund files in there. At least the plan is in place. When it'll actually come to fruition, I can't tell you. It'd be a long time, probably, without significant additional resources. But there is a steady trickle of data that is being loaded into the two new electronic systems. One is called OnBase, and the other is Equus. Equus is, many of you are familiar with it, it's going to be a platform for the technical data, so it'll be your chemistry information and your groundwater data, and OnBase basically will just have all of the paper records digitized and available in it. So a lot of data has already gone in, but when you look at the all the data that needs to go in, we've just scratched the surface. But at least the infrastructure is in place, and now it's just a question of the MPCA chipping away at it and getting all the information in there.
I can say, too, that from the responsible parties side of things, the consent orders that we sign on these sites or that our clients sign on these sites requires that all the information that we collect goes into the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. So all of the information in our files, the data, if you will, whether they're drilling logs or water quality data or water allowed levels, is transmitted to the agency. So it's not like the consultants have a whole stable of information that's not available publicly.
And maybe a few of the old hands can write a douse and tell memoir. Doug.
Yeah, as an example of making that kind of information public, we've been working for Hennepin County, who has a site live now for the Bassett Creek area just west of downtown Minneapolis. And so if you go to Hennepin County's website, they have a tool called the EDAT, Environmental Data Access Tool, and it's a GIS-based information center, and you can dive into the reports. There are dozens of sites in that particular area. The county invested in this because it's ripe for redevelopment. And so it's maybe an example of what perhaps the agency can do down the road, but Hennepin County, with EPA funding, took it on themselves to put this together. And so it's maybe the kind of tool that would make this kind of thing available more broadly if the resources are available to do it.
That's very good. Over here?
Do add to what Sandeep was saying about the data. I'm the data quality coordinator for St. Louis River area of concern for Minnesota side. And one of the things that the AOC is working on, that which includes two Superfund sites, is to, with the help of NOAA, we are building a data portal for all of the Great Lakes, but St. Louis River is going to be the first, or almost the first. So the goal, our goal is to make sure that all this public money we are spending on Great Lakes is going to be available to the public. And it's at a concept stage right now. We are building they are doing the software development, and hopefully by this time next year, we'll have that running.
Did you want to comment, Alan?
I have a question for Sandeep. I was interested in your initiative number 11, a revised involvement with US EPA and the Superfund program and so forth. Will that ultimately result in a revised deferral agreement and so forth? I mean, the responsible parties that I work with are always interested in knowing who they're going to be regulated by and what that's going to look like. And, you know, there are nuances between the EPA and the MPC's approach to things. So it would be good if that was a part of the record, I guess.
So what Al is talking about is a pilot project called the deferral pilot project that dates back to the mid-90s, where EPA essentially transferred the primacy for, I think it was about 15 sites, 15 NPL sites, where the primacy for oversight got transferred from EPA to the NPCA. And this was a very significant delegation where EPA basically said, we'll be hands-off. We rely on NPCA to do all the work, make all the decisions. EPA concurrence is not formally required. And so this pilot project went into effect. It was a streamlining measure. It's mostly been successful. There's been, in my tenure in Superfund, there are just two sites where the deferral project was, rescinded perhaps, and the primacy was transferred back to US EPA. In both of those cases, there was significant communication with the RP prior to that happening. We didn't want, neither us nor EPA wanted any surprises, because EPA would then take over working with the RP, and EPA didn't want to come in, nor would we want that to happen to the RP, where they came in any kind of adversarial situation with a smooth transition. So the only two cases I'm aware of where a site in the deferral project was handed back to EPA, there was significant consultation, communication with the RP, so we had a smooth transition. And both the sites, I think, have benefited from that transition and EPA taking over the oversight. And if we do that for any more sites, certainly that's the model we would, you know, seek to repeat.
Back in the corner.
Yes, PCA is getting some of the documents out on the web. If you go to What's in My Neighborhood, you'll see that some of the sites actually have letters out there, and we're pushing them to get the other documents like the phase ones and phase twos out there. But I'm not sure when that's going to happen.
All right, thank you. Any other questions? Yes. Let's get a microphone to you.
So this question is for all five of you. If you had to do your work during the age of social media, how would it have changed what you do? Each one has to answer.
In a minute or less, we're getting up to the hour.
I think we all are doing our work in the age of social media. It's here and upon us. I was very happy to volunteer Hans Navy, who one of my supervisors, for the MPCA Twitter pilot project. So Hans has taken that on in my place. So that was my first act to navigate this new world. But all just apart, I think we are. I think the important thing for us is transparency and simplicity in what we do. So it's simple things like, plain language and getting away from some of the excessive bureaucracy, perhaps, and doing things that the public can understand and that we can explain to the public, because there's a lot of interest, and transparency is the name of the game. So I think we are trying to do things as simply and as clearly as we can, and then put it out there. I mean, there's a lot of emphasis, and going back to Bruce Olson's question, we are trying to get data out there. If you look at the MPCA Superfund website, the MPCA Brownfields website, and if you followed those websites, you'll have noticed a distinct change in the last couple of years. A lot more information on there, and a lot more information that's simple and easy to absorb. So, you know, as best as government can, we are trying to adjust to that. And it's a need, and it makes our job easier. It takes away a lot of the inquiries, the phone calls, a lot of the manual communication, the time. If we can serve this information out there simply and easily and keep it somewhat interesting looking so people actually go and look at it and take the time to, you know, go through it and get what they can. And MPC is going to a new database. It's a system-wide changeover. It's called the Transformation Project. And when that goes online, you'll see a tremendous increase in web-based data. Not just the MPCS cleanup programs, but a lot of the inspection programs, the compliance programs. A lot of information is going to be served out on simple web-based applications that anyone can navigate. So that's the big effort. As I said, there's a Facebook, MPCS on the Facebook. There's a Twitter pilot project where a lot of MPCA leadership have been asked to participate and tweet regularly and keep everybody connected with what we're doing and what changes are happening and what major projects we're working on. So there's a concerted effort to be more easily accessible in a virtual sense, but also to make sure the information we're providing is interesting, it is vibrant, it is not something that people, you know, gloss over when they look at it, but they actually do digest it and they go over better informed.
Seems like the social media done well and thoughtfully would give an agency the opportunity to get ahead of the communication curve and consult with affected people ahead of time and explain the risk, as opposed to the historic explaining what you did and defending why you did it and shutting down the communication. So it's a real opportunity that I'm glad I'm not going to be around to have to implement. Good luck. Good luck.
I work for a law firm, and law firms are conservative. We have web pages now, and that is about it.
Don't you tweet?
We do not tweet. We're not on Facebook. But that's for a reason. It's because we represent clients, and we have confidentiality obligations and ethical obligations. So we really can't be out there talking about clients' cases in social media. That being said, we can certainly. I have clients who are quite effective at using social media to get their points of view across to the public. And I agree that I think the particularly for agencies, that it gives you a great new advantage for how to convey difficult concepts. One of the issues in Superfund has always been when you get to the remedy stage, there's a public hearing. And this, no matter how many years you have been in talking about what the remedy is, there are always people who show up saying, why didn't you tell us about this? And then you sometimes start the process over again. I think the effective use of social media could circumvent that a lot.
I think my answer is about the same as Jim's. I mean, I am on Facebook because I asked my son what's going on. He said, just see it on Facebook. It's all in there. So so I had to get on Facebook. But what our clients are very sophisticated in social media. So what BAR does is really support them in their efforts, depending on what they're trying to do through a social media context and so forth. And I do agree with Jim also that you know, you get to the public meeting, it's better that the public knows what's going on than sort of have to figure it out at the meeting. So I suspect that, you know, if we're involved in a remedy selection, that the client is either going to support EPA or the MPCA in their efforts on social media, or will do something themselves, depending on how much confidence they have in that decision.
And I don't have anything to add to what the other panelists had to say. I think they were rather complete.
It's nice.